The following programming is sponsored by
MBC Media.
The views expressed do not necessarily reflect this station, its management, or Beasley Media Group. Hey, Uncle Sam, put your name at the top of his list. And a Statue of Liberty started shaking her fist. And an eagle will fly, and it's gonna be here. When you hear Mother Freedom start ringing her bell, and it'll feel like the whole.
Good afternoon, Philadelphia. Welcome back to the Conservative Voice on WWDB AM 860 in Philadelphia. That was an interesting conversation we just had with Steve Lucy, the rancher, on the beef wars. And you know, the point of part of this is seeing what's happened not just to ranchers, which is obviously a unique business in some ways, but it's actually the same as what's happened to every small business. So the forces that have been really affecting these businesses are that this low-cost capital and the rise of private equity and other vehicles that weren't existing before have caused a massive amount of consolidation that has really shifted the profitability from small independent operators to large consolidated companies. And That is putting pressure on everybody.
You mean the government getting involved didn't help their businesses? The government and their regulations didn't make things better for them? That's so weird. That's the opposite of what I've been reliably assured.
It turns out it didn't help. So when you look at the collection of regulators that are hitting the beef industry, it's you know, federal, multiple agencies, EPA, you know, USDA, all these agencies. All of those are repeated at the state level. And then you, in some places, you got these goofballs that are local officials that think they should be weighing in on big issues. So they create regulations that have, in many cases, very poorly written, really outside their jurisdiction. They shouldn't be really doing this. So what's happened is small business has been crushed, consolidation and regulation being two drivers. We've driven a lot of the employment away from small business up to the big corporates. That's changed the nature of employment and opportunity in this world, you know, economic freedom in this country. And in this particular case, these four big players, through regulation and consolidation, have really assumed huge amounts of power. So they've pulled away they've pulled away the share of profit that goes to each step of the supply chain. And so this is something that's a problem across the country, and it comes right back, as it always does. I think every issue tends to come back to economics. So what we're going to do is now welcome back E.J. Antoni.
Back from the swamp.
Back from the swamp, who took a dive into the swamp. And frankly, to be quite honest, we were a little disappointed because we suddenly couldn't have him on the show. And so but you know, he was very kind, got us connected with somebody who would fill in. But EJ is back from the swamp. EJ, welcome to the Conservative Voice on WWDB AM 860 in Philadelphia once again.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's great to be back.
Yeah.
We're so glad to have you.
Yeah, although, you know, I really had mixed emotions here because I could see if you were involved in the Bureau of Labor Statistics, I think we might start getting accurate numbers for the first time
incredible.
In years.
Yeah.
Right? But
You know, that was the goal. That was explicitly why the president asked me to do it.
That's right. And so tell us, if you would, like, what happened? I mean, why did Congress or I guess the Senate specifically react the way it did?
Well, one of the things that I had been warned about, you know, before even accepting the nomination was that, look, there are a lot of senators who just outright do not like Trump. And they like to give him a hard time. And they're also not happy about how, you know, the previous commissioner had been fired. So we knew going into it, it was going to be a very, very tough road.
Yep.
But we assumed that we could at least, for example, get a foot in the door and meet with senators and talk through the issues with them, explain to them all the things that are wrong at the Bureau and all the different ways we can fix it. And why it's so important, not just for the American people, but for them, because they rely on this data to try to set public policy. I mean, that's huge. They actually have an even bigger incentive that the numbers are right than you and I do. But unfortunately, plenty of those folks just weren't even willing to give us the time of day. In other words, we couldn't even have a meeting, and that included some Republicans. And because of that, there was just no way to advance the nomination. So the right thing to do at that point was to just withdraw and to move on.
So now I've got some theories that are possibly right, possibly wrong. But one of those is that a challenge that we would face if you actually trued up the numbers and got them to be accurate is that we would have suddenly things that look much worse than they look today because the numbers we have today are fake. So we might be facing, for example, inflation numbers, which I think come out of BLS, and employment numbers that are really worse. And so people would run around and say, oh, look, an economic collapse Trump is hurting the economy. How was that a risk, or am I wrong about that?
I assume it certainly was a risk. You know, again, like, because I couldn't even have a meeting with some of these folks, there was no way to actually get the information directly from them as to, like, what are your concerns? What are the issues here?
Wow.
So that, you know, again, it was unfortunate. But look, I agree that for a very long time, the BLS has been able to provide government politicians with a fudge factor, if you will, by which they've been able to massage data one way or the other, sometimes
right,
better, sometimes worse. And look, we have talked for a couple years now, I think, on your show about all the ways in which the BLS has been making mistakes and has been presenting erroneous data to the American people, which sometimes they end up admitting later is wrong and they correct it. And some of that data, unfortunately, has never been corrected.
Yeah. You know, and I've seen this. It seems to me that some of these numbers have been so egregiously wrong that it couldn't really be a mistake, right? I mean, to me, it seems political. You want to try to artificially lower inflation numbers so it starts looking like wages are beating inflation in the back half of the Biden years. You want to try to beef up the employment numbers so they put in all those government jobs. I don't remember the biggest number, but it was a huge number of government jobs 1 month that seemed to be designed to fill a hole to the reader on the outside, right? And you know, obviously the people at BLS don't talk. They just publish numbers, so we never hear from them what they're thinking. But it certainly seemed to me to be politically motivated, and reversing that would be a loss of a weapon that, whomever it is, you know, the Democrats, the globalists, the establishment, whatever you call these people, the Uniparty, they would lose a weapon that they wield in election to steer election outcomes. Am I just too jaded?
Well, look, at the end of the day, it really, I'm not even sure it even matters if this was from incompetence or malice. And the reason I say that is because if problems just happen every once in a while, or a problem happens once, but then it gets fixed, you can say, all right, maybe somebody was trying to, you know, cook the books or whatever you want to call it, but the problem was caught and it was fixed. Or maybe there was some incompetence, but the problem was caught and it was fixed. However, once the problem is there long enough, mm-hmm, and nobody does anything to fix it, despite plenty of people from the outside pointing it out and calling it out, at that point, it becomes so inexcusable that I don't think it even matters whether or not it's from malice or it's from incompetence. Either way, the people in charge need to go. Because it's like Harry Truman, where he had that sign on his desk that said, the buck stops here, right? At some point, the person in charge is responsible for the data that's getting published. And if it's garbage, then that person needs to be held accountable for publishing that garbage. And again, this was not a matter of it being a one-off. This was a matter of it being a problem that went on for years, and people had talked about it for years and proposed solutions for years, and nothing had been done to actually fix it.
I was going to say, your use of the word mistake was quite generous, because when the mistakes only go one direction and only push one narrative, they look less like innocent mistakes and more like intentional deception. So, you know, it was nice of you to use the word mistake, but I heard error intentional on my end. It seems intentional.
Well, again, this is where you have to wonder, you know, it is what's going on. Is there political motivation behind it? And you know, because I never got the opportunity to go to the agency and actually investigate these things, I can't definitively say either way. I will say I actually know some of the folks at BLS, and at least the ones I know are good people who are trying to do the right thing, but they have been frustrated time and time again by a lack of leadership. For example, some of them have actually come up with solutions for some of the data problems. In other words, they have come up with, and they've not only, you know, theorized, but they've actually tested ways to make the data better. Mm-hmm. And they've essentially said, look, we have some of these things ready to go, but we need the permission to actually make the changes so that we can implement these fixes. And people just sit on them. In other words, the leadership won't give them the green light to go ahead. I'm sorry, but that's just inexcusable. People need to be held to account for that.
Yeah, they really do. So I can't imagine being upset that person got removed from that job because it was going so badly. But I guess, again, it comes back to the nefarious intent that I believe is there. But, you know, one of the challenges we have now is that we really don't know, if you're looking at the official numbers, you really don't know what unemployment is, what inflation is. And if you're making economic decisions based on that, if you're planning projects or hiring trends or something, I think it's very difficult to make decisions with such flawed data.
Oh, it certainly is. And see, that's a big reason why what a lot of people have been doing since the pandemic has been looking elsewhere for data. So right now, obviously, with the government shutdown, there's no regular schedule of publication. The only reason we got the last inflation report for the month of September was because it's needed in order to, under statute, in order to do things like have cost of living or COLA adjustments for Social Security, et cetera. But other than that, we're not getting any of this regularly published data. Mm-hmm. However, before this shutdown had started looking elsewhere for this data because since the pandemic, there's been a serious erosion of trust in these numbers, whether it's the inflation data, whether it's the jobs data, you name it. A lot of the numbers coming out of BLS have just proven to be so inaccurate that, again, people have already been looking elsewhere. So it's not as even though this started magically on October 1st of this year. It's been going on for quite a while. So I'll look at, just as a few examples, I'll look at the 12 regional Federal Reserve banks and the surveys that they conduct within their respective districts to try to get a sense of how is the economy doing? How are consumers doing? How are businesses doing? What are credit conditions like? What's happening with prices? What's happening with the labor market? We have other private data from things like the Conference Board. Again, lots of different areas that you can look for to try to get a sense of what's really going on with the economy.
Yeah, and, you know, it's the employment side, and it's also the inflation side. I think on the employment side, Rasmussen does a poll.
Yeah, the real unemployment, right?
Yeah, and so they
I was thinking that.
Yeah, they came out, I think, with a number that last time they ran the poll, which was a couple of weeks ago, was at like 8.3%, which was relatively unchanged. So that wasn't a big aberration. And so they're basically saying, based on their polling, and unemployment is about twice what the government says it is.
Well, you know, again, one of the things that we have to keep in mind when we hear things like the unemployment rate, how do you classify unemployment? Mm-hmm. That may sound like it's really simple, right? But you want to distinguish between who is actually not just working, but what kind of work do they have? In other words, maybe I have a part-time job. Okay, I'm employed, but I'm really looking for a full-time job. I just can't find one. Well, how do we want to classify that person, right?
Yep.
And also, is my difficulty in the fact that economic conditions, in other words, a sluggish economy, are preventing me from finding the full-time job that I want? Or is it something else? Maybe I'm helping take care of an elderly parent. And so I need to be available at home, and I can't work a regular 9-to-5. I can only work, you know, a few hours a day. All these different things are, mm-hmm. are really, really important. And that's why we have so many different classifications of the unemployment rate. And so even if you do look at BLS data, you have the you have not only a what we consider like the standard unemployment rate, or U3,
yeah,
but we have all the U6. Way up to U6,
yeah,
which is going to align much more closely, I think, with the kinds of with the kinds of questions that are being asked in those types of polls.
So U3 is the one that's often reported in the media, right? But U6, that includes people that are underemployed or maybe aren't working but would like to, aren't looking but would like to. This number that Rasmussen put out was unemployed but looking, according to their polling, and they have different breakdowns in this report they do. But whatever the numbers are, I think it's been my impression for some time that unemployment is a bigger problem than what we are being led to believe by the business press, if you will.
You know, it's a really good question. Part of the problem is the mismatch today.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, you have millions of job openings. At the same time, you have millions of people looking for work. So why aren't those people taking those jobs? Some of it has to do with the big problem with today's youth. You have these recent college grads who don't want to take anything other than, like, it's almost like they're looking for their ideal job.
Yeah.
And if they can't get that, they don't want anything. I mean, I bartended for 10 years.
Same.
It's not as if as soon as I graduated, I got the ideal job that I always wanted. So there, you have phenomena like that previously were not anywhere near as prevalent. You also do have, I will say, a mismatch in skills.
Yes.
Where you have plenty of people who, you know, they go to college and they get a degree in gender studies or something else that ends in the word studies. And it provides them effectively with no useful skills that are applicable to today's workplace. The result of that is, there are plenty of openings for things like plumbers, welders, carpenters, electricians, masons, mechanics, and college degree, again, that ends in the word studies, you have none of the prerequisites to do any of those jobs. So you have things like that as well, those kinds of skill mismatches.
Those kids were all pushed to colleges and to four-year universities, and they managed to make what should have been a high school elective class into a four-year degree and are furious that they can't find a job in their selected elective, you know, degree mm-hmm. path. And it's everyone else's fault. It's everyone else's problem.
Well, I think to some degree they were told that they could go do, you know, this was the follow your
well,
bliss
sure.
time, right? They were all follow your bliss. Oh, you like this? Go do it. Go follow.
Yeah.
Don't worry about the economics or something as fundamental as having a job. You know, follow your bliss. We're in a new world now. And so I was talking to some young folks recently, you know, let's say 30s, you know, and they were saying they're having a very hard time getting any kind of traction with employment where they could start getting on a career path. Their career paths in some cases have been disrupted by corporate mergers or downsizing and all this. They don't have technical degrees. They don't have plumbing skills, right? So they're really just out in this sort of nebulous gray market. And they're also struggling on the social side because of the social changes that have happened, where if you want to sort of, you know, like start a family, that's now considered somewhat of a radical thing to do. It's something that if you look at the polling, a lot of the young ladies aren't interested necessarily in getting married and having children, and a big demographic of the young men are interested in getting married and having children.
There's a morality gap between young men and young women right now that essentially makes them incompatible. The men want more of a traditional lifestyle and future, and the women have been poisoned by radical feminism and don't understand why they're medicated and so unhappy in their 30s and still single. And it's a morality difference, I really think, down to its core, that is making it so difficult for young adults right now.
Serious social changes. And so when we look at this, you know, the examples I just gave, EJ, and you know, this discussion about the mismatch in skills, you know, where is the economy really sitting right now? Like, is it getting better for people? Is it not getting better? What do you see happening?
Well, I suppose the pithy answer is it depends, right? It depends on who you are. For certain folks, things are clearly getting better. For others, it's gotten worse. Yeah, I can give you a few examples. If you're one of those people who was getting rich off of government subsidies for things like solar panels or wind farms, clearly things have gotten worse for you because a lot of those subsidies have been taken away. Now, I personally think that's a good thing.
Yes.
But whatever the case, you know, that's just one example. But you do have others, right? You have a lot of changes in the economy because of tariffs. Some of those have been good. Some of those have been bad. Some of those changes are going to be short term, right? It's a temporary disruption. Others are going to be permanent. So there are some cases where people, sadly have lost jobs because of all of these changes. There are other folks, though, who have gained jobs. And sometimes it's the same person, right?
Yeah.
Sometimes a person loses a job with company A, but now it gets one with company B. So it's hard to overstate here. A lot of parts of this economy are in flux right now. There are a lot of changes because we are having to undo almost everything that was done the previous 4 or 5 years. We're having to reprivatize an economy, take it off of government dependence, whether that's in government spending or government hiring. So it's a lot of change, and a lot of change all at once invariably causes disruptions, not just within the economy, but within people's lives, financial and otherwise.
Yeah.
But it's change we voted for. It's change we very clearly wanted and demanded. I say it all the time. We said we wanted a smaller government, and that was our priority. And it appears they didn't listen and they didn't believe us. But that's what we wanted. So these changes are necessary for our survival, as far as I'm concerned. We can't continue on with this heavy government subsidy, the heavy government control and power, and thrive. We're not thriving as a country. These changes are required to make it possible.
And you know, one of the things that I think is really interesting, since you brought up the smaller government aspect of it, and you're absolutely right. I do think that's what people voted for.
Mm-hmm.
But with a smaller government, with less spending and less borrowing and less money creation, means less inflation, right?
Yes.
And what we've seen so far this year has been that the average American's weekly paycheck has grown faster than inflation. In other words, not only is the average American's weekly paycheck bigger, but it can buy about 1% more than it could back in January. Conversely, under Biden, even though those paychecks grew very, very quickly, they did. That's true. Inflation was so much worse than earnings increases that price increases therefore outpaced earnings growth. And so your larger paycheck at the end of 4 years bought you about 4% less.
And we saw that with the first administration with Trump as well. We saw tremendous wage growth, or the purchasing power that we had. We saw incredible unemployment numbers with the lowest income earners. Those numbers were incredible. There was so much upward mobility in those 4 years that we could see and track, that we've slid backwards in the last 4 years that we now need to recoup. But like you just said, EJ, it does seem to be that the rebound is happening quickly. It's a quick rebound in those metrics.
Yeah, very, very much so. And this is where you look and you say, okay, going back to your original question, is the economy better or worse? I would say, given that we're talking about the average American's weekly paycheck, I think it's fair to say then the average American is doing better.
That's
not to say they're doing great.
Right.
It's all sunshine and rainbows or whatever. It's not. I mean, people are still really hurting, and I think we got to emphasize that, because you know, part of the reason why I think voters rejected Kamala Harris was the way she was so dismissive to people who were suffering. And so I don't want to be dismissive of people who are suffering. Like we were just saying, the average American lost 4% of their real earnings under Biden.
Yep.
They've gained 1% back. That still means they're down from where they were, you know, before the pandemic.
Yeah.
So, that, you know, again, I just want to emphasize we're doing better. We're on the right track, but we still got to do more work, right? It's not done yet.
So if if the administration, which has said from EPA and other agencies, they're targeting hundreds of thousands of regulations that are duplicative with state regulations, duplicative with federal regulations, burdensome, unnecessary. They're talking about removing hundreds of thousands of regulations. And if you add up the estimates that I think they've put out, it's something like a $4 trillion burden on the economy. If they actually do that, what happens?
Oh, my goodness. You see an economic boom. And I'll tell you a story to kind of help illustrate that. Aside from, you know, the trillion-dollar number, multi-trillion-dollar number that you just cited, during the, I guess you could call it Trump's interim between his two terms, he got together a group of over 100 leaders, and these were folks ranging from small businesses to Fortune 100 CEOs, right? So mm-hmm. we're talking about a good cross-section of American businesses. And he asked them a very Trumpian question, right? During my first term, what was the best thing I did? Regulation, or was it the tax cuts? Which helped your business more? Which one affected your profits more, your ability to hire people, et cetera?
Mm-hmm.
Every single one of those 100-plus business leaders all said that the deregulation actually helped them more than the tax cuts did. And that's saying something, because the tax cuts clearly saved them hundreds of billions of dollars. So the deregulation saved them even more. And what we are seeing out of the current administration is an even bigger push to regulatory reform than we saw in Trump 1.0. So that makes me very, very bullish on the economy.
All right, so let me lay out the scenario then. If let's say that they succeed, the administration succeeds and cuts these regulations, hundreds of thousands, a multi-trillion-dollar impact, they succeed in they already succeeded in extending the tax cuts that were set to expire. So the benefit we got in 2017, 2018, 2019 from those tax cuts are now extended. So that's done. That's the second leg to the stool. And then the third leg to the stool is this investment of trillions of dollars that have been committed to not just data centers, which I'm not as excited about, but actual investments in real businesses that generate jobs. If that starts, and I'm thinking, you know, you look at timelines, that can't even begin to land until the end of 26. But if those trillions of dollars of private investment from overseas and domestic sources begin to hit, what I think happens then is just a trifecta. We end up with the magic wand, if you will. You know, the American magic wand gets waved, and we have an economic resurgence of a sort we haven't seen in a long time.
I think that's fair, absolutely. And one of the things that I do want to note, though, on things like these data centers and AI, a lot of times people today talk about AI eliminating jobs. In other words, mm-hmm. we're looking at AI in most cases as a substitute for labor.
Yep.
I don't have to hire somebody because I can have the machine do it. But AI is also increasingly proving to be a complement to labor. In other words, human capital is able to use this, electronic capital, if you will, in order to be more efficient,
mm-hmm.
in order to get more work done. I use AI all the time to make myself more work done. And that frees me up to do other work. So just because there's a net increase in total productivity doesn't necessarily mean you're going to see a net decrease in jobs. In fact, sometimes it's exactly the opposite. The other thing is, if you get investment, let's say, to build a factory,
mm-hmm.
while it's true that it's going to take a couple of years until that factory is up and running,
mm-hmm.
and it's employing people, long before then, the factory actually starts employing people. Because think of it, don't you have to employ construction workers to build the factory?
Yep.
And even before that, don't you have to employ architects to design it? Don't you have to employ people to do the land surveys?
Yep.
Don't you have to employ people to get through all the government regulation? And hopefully we're reducing a lot of that government regulation to speed up the process. But the point is that almost immediately you actually start seeing additional people employed and additional work done long before that factory churns out a single car or a single microwave,
yep.
or a single T-shirt or a single widget, you know, whatever the case may be.
Yeah, you know, I always watch the Architectural Billings Index to see where that's going, and it's not showing yet that there is an upsurge in the architectural side on some of the projects that be required to get these projects underway. But as I think about the timing from commitment of capital, concept of project, engaging the engineers, the architects, the surveyors, and all of that, you know, it's a it is a timeline. I'll tell you, one of the best leading indicators for construction and for projects, corrugated pipe, because they throw it in the ditch that they drive over with the tractors and the bulldozers and equipment when they start doing the dirt work. That's one of the, if you could see a spike in corrugated pipe sales, you can bet that there's a construction surge coming.
That's such a great point, and it speaks to how how complex our supply chains are, right? If you're going to build something like a factory, you don't just wave a magic wand and it appears the next day, right? These things take a tremendous amount. And this is where, you know, going earlier about how this is going to take time to do things like reprivatize the economy.
Right? Yes.
It's going to take time to fix everything. The full expensing that we just got back because of the One Big Beautiful Bill Act that was passed earlier this year, you know, back during the summer, what we see from that is going to be a big return, or I should say what we will see from that is going to be the same surge in investment that you saw back in 2018. And we know that not only because when it was applied in the first Trump administration, we got the big investment boom, but also when it was taken away under Biden because they allowed it to expire and didn't do anything to, you know, to prevent that. What was the result? The result was that you had a big drop in investment, particularly the kind of investment that fuels long-run economic growth, and that would be private fixed domestic investment. That's where you get things like the factories.
Yep.
That's also where you get things like the software that we use to run computers, et cetera. It's where you get all of the different things that people tend to use to make them more productive and get higher wages. So what I'm getting at here is, yes, it's going to take time to actually get all of the positive results that we're looking for, but the fact that we have the first step is so important.
Well, just to give you a snapshot that illustrates what you just said, you know, we talked about this billing index. Now, that shows how much architects are employed, you know, how many hours of work they have at their desk. And in March of 22, it peaked at a positive number into the growth range. It's 58, 50 being neutral and below 50 being contraction. It fell below 50 later in 2022, and it has struggled ever since and hasn't yet turned around. It now what I expect to see over the next, say, I don't know, 9-12 months is I expect to see that start to reverse as some of these projects get to fruition. EJ, it is really great to have you back with us here, and we're really glad you called in. And you know, while I think it's a loss for the Bureau of Labor Statistics, it's a win for us. So I'm just going to be selfish here and celebrate it.
Agreed.
So thank you for joining us.
Certainly. Hey, look, it's my pleasure. And at the end of the day, whether it's, you know, at the BLS or whether it's on great shows like yours, we're still going to advocate for the same types of reforms, right? We're still going to be advocating for making the government better, leaner, meaner, more efficient, and better able to serve the American people and be a better steward of taxpayer dollars. That's what we're here for, and that mission continues.
Well, and that's perfectly said. So thank you so much. And by the way, it's a perfect segue into our next conversation.
Yeah.